Hi, this is State Delegate Mark Corman, and from Wisconsin Avenue in District 16 to Pratt Street in Baltimore to the Boardwalk on the Eastern Shore and everywhere in between, Conduit Street Podcast is the go-to source for news about Maryland politics and policy.
Welcome to the Conduit Street Podcast. Kevin Canale here with Michael Sanderson. Michael, it is Thursday, May 18th. Kind of a big event coming up this Saturday in Baltimore. I know you and I are really interested. What do you think about the Preakness?
I'm glad to be back on the pod. And I would say I'm really interested in this field. It's kind of unusual. Usually we get a bunch of horses who come off that fun little prep race they run over in Louisville a couple weeks ago. And we usually have several from the Kentucky Derby field who run in the Preakness, and you sort of get to talk about who had bad luck and all those sorts of things. And this year, the only Derby horse in the Preakness field is the Winter Mage. But it looks to me like there's a number of interesting contenders here, horses who were on the Kentucky Derby trail and sort of faded out or just weren't sharp that week or that sort of thing. So I don't know. I don't think Mage needs to be a super heavy favorite. He might go off at even money or so because he's the most familiar name. But I think there's a lot of good horses in this field.
Yeah, I think so too. I know you like a few horses. I like a few horses. A couple of the new shooters. What would be your picks for our listeners for Saturday? You're a horse racing guy. Who you got? Well,
I would say the horse that intrigues me the most is honestly National Treasure. Mm-hmm. And the reason is we have seen horses who don't look super high quality grab the rail, get an easy lead at Pimlico, and just coast. Even though the Preakness is a relatively long race for horses this young, we have seen sort of cheap speed run away and hide and win this race. And I think he's going to get the post position number one. He's right in the perfect spot. John Velasquez can take him right to the lead, and I think he's got a chance to just steal it on the front. He may not be the highest quality horse here, but that I don't know, that playbook seems pretty obvious to me. I think he's got the fleetest foot early of anyone in this field, maybe except the farthest outside horse, number eight, First Mission, who I think is going to be the wise guy horse here.
I agree. So I have a different take on getting the lead. I like Coffee with Chris, I think. Yeah. He's going to be able to get out early, and the question becomes, can he hold it? I think this is a horse that could be one of those rare winners that leads from wire to wire, but yep. We'll have to see. He's going off at 20-1. I like that. I think he's a good pick to add to Exotics, maybe even Exactas. So that's my horse. And what do you think about Chase the Chaos? I think you and I like him a little bit too.
I mean, he's going to be a bomber at the end, right? He's going to want to make a run late, and It's just tough to know what this horse is, but you can make a story out of a lot of 2-year-old into 3-year-old horses that if they just put together the effort from here and the effort from there, then they can put together one big race. But he's going to be a big price. Like, your horse is 20-1, and that's pretty bold. I mean, Chase the Chaos is in the morning line at 50 and might, I don't know. I mean, I guess because of a Derby long shot won last year, so people will bet down the highest odds horse, but right, He'll still be 40-1 or so. That's a bummer.
There's some value there for sure. And we may have some weather too on Saturday. What does that do to the field? How does that affect the way they're going to run, you think?
I think it's tough to know. I mean, your horse Coffee with Chris, like 2 out of 3 on and off track. So that's not a bad indicator. I don't know. I'll spend a little time looking at pedigrees and stuff like that to see if there might be some angle there. That data is scattered all over the place. But, you know, what better to do on Friday night?
Yes. No, check Michael's Twitter account Friday night and Saturday. He'll have some updates, I'm sure. But now that we got that out of the way, Michael, everybody wanted our picks, your picks. Let's get into our main topic for today. Let's talk about the federal debate over the debt ceiling and how it might have Maryland effects. And Michael, we're going to get into this. We'll talk nuts and bolts, but we really want to focus on Maryland and county governments and how they could be affected, because that's our bag, right? So how this whole debate surrounding Congress and the president and what they're going to do, suspend or raise the debt ceiling, how that could potentially affect us back home here.
Yeah, I don't think like covering federal politics isn't exactly our bag, but you know, you wrote a nice piece on the Conduit Street blog this earlier this week on Wednesday that sort of laid out this issue a little bit and talked about what the consequences could be, both at the federal level, but we can't help but think about the state of Maryland and our Maryland local governments and what it might happen for the local economy and for our residents and that sort of stuff. So I think we want to focus on that as part of our angle here. But I also feel like you covered really nicely the nuts and bolts of the issue. And I don't know, I feel like there's more to talk about. So we wanted to do the pod and kind of dig a little deeper.
First of all, let's just get into the debt limit. And I want to emphasize here, we're not going to be partisan, but it is important to know we're not talking about new spending. Congress is not trying to authorize new spending. But this is, hey, we've already committed to this over the years under different presidents, under different Congresses. And turns out when you don't have enough revenues coming in to pay your bills, you need to go out and borrow more money. And that's what's going on right now, right? The Treasury has reached its limit. They're sending off warnings that they're going to run out of money to pay the bills by as early as June 1st. And what they need to do is get Congress to authorize either suspending or raising the debt limit. And that's kind of where we are right now. We know there's been a lot of back and forth between House Republicans who have a slim majority pushing the envelope here saying, we're not going to talk about raising the debt ceiling or suspending the debt ceiling unless Democrats agree to big spending cuts. And so right now, Congress is negotiating with the White House. Republicans are negotiating with Democrats. It seems like they may be making a little progress, Michael. I know that, you know, the U.S. dollar performed pretty well overnight, and I think that was based off indications that Republicans and Democrats want to strike a deal and avert the government defaulting on its debt, which would be terrible for many reasons, which we'll get into. Yeah. But that's sort of the lay of the land and where we are right now, right?
Right. And so like the mechanics of this are not really easy to understand, even from a lot of the press coverage that I've read. But for all intents and purposes, Congress has to pass a bill, send it to the president's desk for the president to sign and approve. That's how you make this change. It's not like you just take one little vote and you give a big thumbs up and it's all done. You're actually just passing a bill, mm-hmm. which means you have to have agreement with the House of Representatives that has a slim Republican majority, and then with the U.S. Senate, that's effectively 50-50, but modestly in Democratic control, and you have to have the president agree, and that's, you know, Democratic Party. So you have to have multiple players sign on to whatever the final deal is, and it's all got to get done literally before we can't pay for the government. You hit that important point, though. This isn't talking about what's the trajectory of spending going forward. This isn't like we're going to pass next year's budget and it's got a big spending growth. This is just the means to support the stuff that we've already spent and already passed.
Right. I mean, if you think about it, this would be like going to your credit card company and saying, hey, I need to increase my limit, right? This is already stuff that's on my card, but I need to be able to increase my limit. I need some more room. And where the U.S. Treasury is now, Treasury is using what they call extraordinary measures, right? And that allows them to move things around, make some room, but eventually you run out, right? There are no more measures you can take. And that's what the U.S. Treasury is doing now. So what they need to do to pay the bills and to make sure that you don't miss Social Security payments and unemployment insurance and stuff like that is they need to be able to issue new securities. So we're talking about Treasury notes, bonds, and that's all debt that's owed by the federal government, so that we can keep paying our bills and make sure we don't default on the debt that we have. And that's what they're asking Congress to do, is to allow them to incur more debt so that they can keep the wheels turning.
Right. And I guess what lies in the background here, practically speaking, is even though the entire Congress and the president need to agree on a solution, I think the practical effect here is that this looks like it's happening on the given president's watch. Mm-hmm. So in the event that the government were to default on bonds and basically tell people who have loaned the money to the U.S. federal government, sorry, we can't make our payment. We can't, you know, if that actually happens, because that's one of the things that we spend money on in the budget, is to just pay debt service on our current debt.
Right.
So if you can't, if you don't have the money to afford spending, you know, the operating budget of the federal government, you can't pay the debt on stuff you've already borrowed. So that's why the default possibility looms. But I think it's that creates leverage, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're a member of Congress and you have been trying to get something done and it's really important to you, or you're a leadership in Congress and that's what you've been trying to do and you can't get something done, getting it attached to something that has to pass is the time-honored way. So you get your pet issue tacked on top of a big important appropriations bill, or you know, a big important bill that everybody agrees on, and that's a, you know, a time-honored way of getting small things done in DC. Well, here, these are big issues. It's big philosophical differences over the overall amount of spending and fiscal policy by the federal budgets and by the president and by the Congress. And if you're in Congress saying, I want to see restraint in spending, this feels like your opportunity to do that. Let's get make that a rider on the bill that has to pass to change the debt ceiling. I'll vote for all that stuff as long as I get other things that I want. And so that brings us to where we are.
Right. And raising or suspending the debt limit, let's be clear, this is not a new idea, right? And according to the U.S. Treasury, since 1960, Congress has acted 78 separate times to permanently raise, temporarily extend, or revise the definition of the debt limit. And that's been 49 times under Republican presidents, 29 times under Democratic presidents. So this is not a new idea. And, you know, this once was a relatively uncontroversial process, but as you mentioned, it has become increasingly politicized. I think people have realized that, hey, this is something that the government has to do. No one wants to default. Republicans are tying the debt limit negotiations to federal spending cuts. And what they want to see, Michael, is that federal spending be reduced to 2022 levels and that future growth be capped for the next 10 years. Senate Democrats and President Biden are saying, hey, we should not be tying the debt limit negotiations to federal spending cuts. We should address those issues separately. And that's what's going on. So, Michael, right now, we seem to be at an impasse between the House Republicans and the White House. And as you said, this would look like for President Biden that he let this happen. So the House wants budget cuts as part of this deal, Michael, maybe some other things too. That's a big deal for Maryland because we have such a big federal presence here. And let's get into that a little bit, because not many people are talking about, you know, what defaulting on the federal debt would mean, but also what would happen if they did agree to big spending cuts and non-discretionary funding. And we'll talk about that and the impact that it would have on Maryland, because we do rely so much on the federal government. Our workforce does in the state.
Right. And I think that's a piece that you got into pretty clearly in the item that's on the Conduit Street blog. But I mean, it's pretty straightforward to connect the dots here to Maryland. I mean, we literally, you know, we have you know, geography from the state of Maryland created the District of Columbia. We obviously are a hub right around the National Capital Region. So in Maryland, just by physical proximity, we play host to a number of federal agencies. There's lots and lots of federal workers who are Maryland residents who, you know, they come home and they get their haircuts here and they go out to dinner here and they pay their taxes here and so forth. We have a pretty obvious regional connection for Maryland's economy to be connected to the federal government. And this isn't to say that we're partisans for lots and lots of spending, but the fact of the matter is, if we end up with some sort of austerity measures, if this ends up being a deal where the feds have to cut back on spending in some fashion, whether it's in future growth or whether it's in dollars today, you will end up feeling that in the Maryland economy, that some people might lose their jobs at the Social Security Administration or NIH or other places like that are federally funded agencies in the state of Maryland with a lot of Maryland residents as their workers. So, I mean, that's just arithmetic that Maryland has a big stake in the basically just the pace of federal spending. And that's, you know, for better or for worse, that's a large, large underpinning component of the Maryland economy.
Right. And so the House Republicans proposing about a 22% cut to everything non-defense, and that certainly would be a big deal. Michael, there's another issue here, and I think sometimes people conflate these two, the debt limit versus a government shutdown. It's not clear whether a government shutdown could happen here, but I guess that's in the cards. You never know in D.C., right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's conceivable that if we get to June 1st or whatever the drop dead day looks like, and the powers that be in the executive branch say we no longer have the authority to spend money, then you can't tell your employees come in and work for free. So effectively, that would say, okay, you know, take these federal agencies. If you work at NIH, we're just not open, you know, effective Tuesday. And if that happens, we've seen this happen in the past. Not connected to the debt limit, but just over budget impasses. And it's happened a couple of times within my memory. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it's less of a big deal than it sounds like. I mean, it's tumult for those agencies, and it's a pain in the neck for the employees. And if you go 3 weeks without pay, that's a problem for your family. Mm-hmm. But as a practical matter, the feds have always come back and made those employees whole, even if they were furloughed or if the agency were shut down for some window of time. So that probably, I think I'm safe in saying this, that's probably more of like a short-term effect, that you'd have, whatever, 3 weeks of hardship and pain in the neck factor, and then things would be kind of back to normal as there's some sort of a resolution, and then Congress would do right by the employees and not leave them just missing, you know, two biweekly paychecks. So I think that's a I don't know, mechanical problem, but not like a long-term problem. It'd be sort of a bubble issue.
We'll have to see what happens there. I think everything's on the table. I mean, these are two separate issues, right? We're not talking about, the government is funded, right? It has money. We're talking about raising the debt ceiling, which is, again, you know, debt that's already been incurred. As far as federal agencies, you know, they're funded, they can continue to work, but you could have a situation, even if the government doesn't shut down, you could see paychecks be delayed for some of these federal workers. And, you know, we also in Maryland, it's important to know, we have a ton of federal contractors, right? So these aren't federal employees, but they're reliant upon the federal government for contracts, a lot of people in that field as well. So this certainly has a big impact. And I think just talking about this and the threat of defaulting on the debt, or, you know, having to shut down the government for some reason, that does raise concerns, especially here in Maryland, because, again, we're so reliant and our tax revenues are so reliant. We have so many people, federal employees and people that rely on the federal government. Certainly, it's something that we're paying attention to. And that's why we wanted to dive into this a little bit more. And so let's talk about what would happen if Congress and the White House do not reach a deal and pass a bill by the end of May. Again, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says that as soon as June 1st, Treasury may not be able to pay its bills. So let's talk about that a little bit and speculate as to what could happen, because it does get pretty fun.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think this is interesting speculation, and this is like us getting a little out of our lane. This isn't Maryland policy and politics, although I think this whole issue does have such a strong Maryland connection that we're stakeholders here, whether you like it or not. But then, you know, thinking about how this plays out is pretty, like, I don't know, it's pretty interesting. It's amusing.
So I guess the first possibility, Michael, we just default, right? And it's hard to know what that would mean, but all indications are, leading economists are saying this would be dire, right? So let's talk about a little bit about what that could look like if the U.S. just said, you know what, we're going to default on our debt and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, the lay of the land that basically, I think if you take finance classes and study things like bond markets and so forth, there's sort of an underwritten assumption. You talk about when you accept risk, when you invest money in something like a bond, you say, well, I'd be willing to accept more risk as long as I get a higher rate of return. So, you know, the whole idea of junk bonds and so forth, hey, you know, I'm gonna put my money into a bond from some company that I'm not positive is gonna live for the 10 years of this bond, but they're gonna pay me 18% interest to assume that risk. So that feels like an interesting investment to me. I'd be willing to do that rather than play it really safe and take something that has virtually no risk, like just getting a T-bill from the U.S. government, because of course the United States government is gonna make good on its bonds and its borrowing. Mm-hmm. So there's always been this like undercurrent of investing theory that low risk investing should be at low interest rates. And the U.S. government is sort of, well, that's just the pinnacle of stability, because the federal government is always going to have the wherewithal to pay off its borrower or its lenders. Right.
Right.
So here we are with the idea of challenging that sort of rock principle of investing theory and say, well, maybe our assumption that the U.S. federal government is not the most reliable borrower, that's a weird thing. Like no one's really thought that through. I mean, we've seen projections from economists and so forth saying this could trigger a full scale, you know, like major recession across the U.S. economy. It certainly feels like it would raise interest rates, right? It would raise interest rates on federal borrowing. If if they've proven themselves, okay, we sometimes don't pay our debt, then the next round of borrowing would probably have to be at a higher interest rate to induce people to put their money back into treasury bills, right?
Right. And I mean, I think this is sort of a double whammy because, you'd be hit, households would be hit by this and businesses, and the ability for households and businesses to borrow through the private sector to offset the economic pain would also be compromised, right? Because like you said, interest rates would likely soar, including on those financial instruments that households and businesses use the most, which treasury bonds, mortgages, credit card interest rates, they would have a problem there too. So this certainly, again, we don't know exactly what would happen, but it's very likely that interest rates would soar, people would feel that pain, and it would trickle down to households and businesses across the country.
So that's definitely one theory, would be that there'd be an interest rate shock across the entire debt marketplace, and that risk would feel like it's present everywhere. Oh, if it's present in federal treasury bills, then risk is everywhere, and we'd see rates just go up in general. I think there's another possibility, and to bring this back to Maryland, I'm like, bear with me for a second here. But okay, if people who usually invest in what feel like safe instruments, like federal T-bills, I'm buying a 10-year note or a 1-year note or whatever from the federal government, I want to take very little risk, I'm willing to take relatively low interest to do that. Those are folks who are looking for quality, right? They're not looking to make that speculative investment in the neighbor's latest cockeyed idea, right? So where do those quality investors go if they suddenly lose faith in the federal government? And one of the reasons I ask is, well, you look for what is a highly regarded, safe, similar kind of investment, sort of like investing with the federal government. And that could be, what about the state of Maryland? Like, the state of Maryland has been AAA rated, the highest tier possible, very highly regarded as a safe investment. The municipal bonds are a little bit different under tax treatment and so forth, but maybe you would consider, maybe I'll put my money into bonds from the state of Maryland or from one of the many counties who have AAA bond ratings. So those might look like more attractive, safe investments to some folks, which in theory, if the demand for your bonds goes up, then you don't have to pay as high of an interest rate. We might actually see interest rates on high quality municipal bonds come down. Right? That seems supply and demand, right?
That would be a weird effect here. And I don't think we're not advocating for that to happen.
No.
But certainly I agree with your theory. I think it has merit. I think it makes sense, right? It's just logical to think, well, if you're looking for somewhere to stash your money and you're looking to invest, the federal government's a mess. The private sector, maybe, interest rates are spiking there. Maybe municipal bonds are a haven, Michael, and maybe that would cause these rates to come down. So that is an interesting side effect here that could happen, right?
It's a could happen, right? It's not a prediction that would be the thing. And I mean, I hope we don't get to this point. I hope we don't face actual default. I guess one of the things that's lying in the background, if you're following this debate nationally, is the former president in, I think, his recent town hall meeting was asked about, what do you think the federal government should just default? And I think he answered that question saying, yeah, it's probably time. We might as well just go ahead and do it. We're going to do it anyway. And I think he was in the mindset of a private businessman, right? His experience is with starting and running private businesses. And the idea of declaring bankruptcy or defaulting on obligations with a private business is a pretty different matter than the federal government as the pace setter for the entire bond market. So, but I don't know if a public comment like that from a figure like the former president, might that change the opinions? Could it harden the resolve of some of the members of the House of Representatives who feel strongly about this? It seems possible. So maybe this issue really is in play. I wouldn't have guessed it a month ago, but maybe.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a separate and interesting side conversation. The former president, he is the front runner in the Republican Party right now. And yeah, I think a lot of people often talk about, well, how much sway does he really have with the Republican Party? For him to make a comment like that, that's certainly, you would think, a signal to Republicans in Congress. And we'll have to see. I mean, does he still hold the water that he once held? Is that going to move the needle in any way? I don't know, but certainly a giant figure like that coming out and saying, yeah, we should just default, that's going to raise some eyebrows. And certainly people are going to be thinking about those comments. And again, we'll see how many people agree with him and how many people are going to get on board with what he would like to see happen here. But that's another possibility here. We don't know, but it's an interesting side effect of this whole thing is the former president going out and saying that. It's pretty remarkable, by the way, to have a former president say, yeah, we should just default on the debt. Like, that's also unprecedented to hear someone actually say that to a national audience.
But here we are. So in addition to just defaulting, though, it feels like, you know, there are some other things coming up in this conversation that might sort of avert the worst outcome. Even if you can't get a bill passed and even if you can't get that stuff done, it seems like, I don't know whether this is, you know, folks just trying to think outside the box or how realistic the options are, but it sounds like there's other stuff that's conceivably on the table, right?
Right. So one of the ideas, Michael, and I think it's mostly a gimmick. There's been conversations about minting a $1 trillion coin. Talk a little bit about that and how that would work, and then we'll get into it a little bit more.
Right. I mean, I guess it's just a matter of you take current federal law authorizes, I guess it's the U.S. Mint, to mint coins of various denominations to be used by the citizenry. So in theory, the U.S. president at any time could just order the mint, go make one coin or make 10 coins that have a value of $1 trillion.
Platinum and coins,
Right. So right. Just make one giant coin, whatever. I don't know. I mean, in my mind, for some reason, the coin is as big as a giant table, right?
Yes, but of course.
I guess it doesn't have to be. It could be the size of a nickel, right?
You could also make a $31 trillion coin, right? It doesn't matter. Right. They could mint, I guess theoretically, they could mint a $1 trillion coin or a $31 trillion coin, right?
Right. So in theory, if you take that law to its maybe absurd extreme, you can say, well, the degree to which the federal government is upside down on its finances is in part a function of how many dollars it has lying around. So, you know, in theory, you could just print the money, or in this case, you mint a giant coin, you just stick it in reserves at Fort Knox or someplace like that and say, well, now that's on our, it's on our balance sheet as an extra $1 trillion. So we've got room to move and we can afford to continue to borrow and continue to get through, you know, making good on our spending obligations we have today. So, I mean, that's the logic of doing that. Almost everybody who talks about it, us included, like start to giggle a little bit with this as a solution. But I don't know. I guess technically it would be legal. I mean, there are countries over the course of history that have fought their economic problems by printing money. And that tends to spur like crazy hyperinflation. And you end up with, you know, countries going into absolute ruin with inflation rates in the thousands of percents and your money on Monday is worthless by Thursday and things like that. So, you know, you don't want to start a spiral like that and you don't want to lose the faith of the people by, you know, by looking like you've done a gimmick or something reckless. But if it's that against an actual default, I guess you consider what are the options.
Right. I do like the idea of them rolling in this giant coin. Right. We don't even know if the Federal Reserve would accept a coin like that. But it, like you said, it doesn't have to be comically large. It could be the size of a nickel, but worth a ton of money. As far as plausibility, Michael, look, it may be legal. I don't know if it passes the political smell test. But the other problem with this is that certainly this would get litigated. Right. And in the meantime, you'd have the U.S. defaulting on its debt while you're waiting around for a judge somewhere to say this is okay or it's not okay. So I think that's part of the issue, that if they wanted to come out with a plan like that and say we're just going to mint this coin, certainly that would end up in court and you'd probably have to weave that case through the legal system, and that would take some time. So I think that's another reason why this is probably not the best option on the table. I think President Biden has sort of dismissed this idea. They're looking at it, but Treasury Secretary Yellen has also said this is not the direction we should be headed. We should ideally be coming to a compromise in Congress with the president to either suspend or raise the limit. But I guess where we are now, as we sit here on May 18th, potentially just a week or two away from default, all options have to be on the table.
Right. And so yeah, if all options are on the table, then yeah, the new novel idea, I guess, is take a look at the law itself that creates the debt limit. And is there an argument that this is a poorly founded federal law itself? Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And that is, we've actually seen a lawsuit by some federal employees saying that the Treasury should just ignore the debt limit, that it doesn't pass constitutional muster, and that they should carry on and continue to issue new debt. And that would be, Michael, invoking the 14th Amendment and declaring the entire debt limit unconstitutional. And that idea is picking up steam. Just tell Treasury to ignore this whole thing and continue on as normal.
Which sounds pretty absurd on its face. And then as you learn more, in my judgment, the absurdity level comes down a good deal. I mean, if you work in public policy, even if you never really studied constitutional law, most people are familiar with the 14th Amendment. Was one of the constitutional amendments passed in the wake of the U.S. Civil War. And it's best known and most often referenced because it provides equal protection under the laws for all Americans. And that equal protection clause is very, very widely used to argue, is this unfair? Is this unconstitutional? It violates the equal protection principle and so forth. So, the stuff you passed in the wake of the Civil War was largely about slavery and about the issues that led to the Civil War itself. And, the mending of American laws in the wake of the Civil War was where you got the 14th Amendment. So why on earth is that relevant here? The debt limit is not an equal protection issue, but in a later text of the 14th Amendment, the parts that people don't talk about with any regularity, there's actually a phrase that speaks about the validity of the public debt of the United States. And it says, shall not be questioned. I mean, there's some other words in the middle there, but that's basically a phrase in there. Apparently, this was a clause in the 14th Amendment to ensure that after the Civil War, the states that had seceded from the Union are brought back into the United States. And there was a political concern, maybe rightly at the time, that the United States government had to finance the Civil War and had to borrow a bunch of money in order to engage the Civil War. And if you're a Southern senator from one of the states that had seceded, are you going to be willing to raise taxes or do what it takes to pay off that debt that was basically used to fight against your residents and the fighters for your state? Mm-hmm. So it was that political worry that said, let's make sure everybody's on board that the validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned. Well, that's in the Constitution.
Right.
So you don't have the luxury of passing a law through Congress that flat out violates the Constitution. And just a plain reading argument seems to suggest if you've got a law that says we stop paying our debt at this many dollars, then effectively, aren't you questioning the validity of the public debt? I mean, right. I'm not a legal scholar, and I'm sure there are plenty of people scratching their heads over what that phrase means today. And it would probably come down to 9 people in Washington to ultimately decide this. But in theory, the executive branch could say, we think this law that's been used and recognized for decades actually is itself unconstitutional. And again, it would be litigated and so forth. Who knows what the courts would do if that were asserted? But it's at least possible that while it was being argued, the federal government would say, we're sticking to our guns. We don't think this law is valid under the 14th Amendment. And so we don't have to abide by it.
Right. So essentially, that argument says that the president must ensure that the federal government does not default pursuant to the 14th Amendment. And again, that phrase shall not be questioned is central to this argument. So that is an interesting side note as well. Another option on the table. Again, it would certainly be litigated, but as you said, if the president decides and his administration decides that this is the route we're going to go, theoretically, as that gets litigated, they could still stick to their guns, like you said, and keep the train on the track. So another interesting side note here. I agree with you. I think the more that you read into it, and the more you read into the lawsuit, again, that was filed by a union that represents federal employees, the way they lay it out, it does seem to make some sense. So, again, this is just another piece to this that will be debated, another option on the table. But, Michael, I mean, let's get into the bottom line here. We got an analysis from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities that, if what the Republicans want, their debt ceiling and cuts bill It would cost state and local governments $1.3 trillion, and that's money for healthcare, education, transportation, climate, other essential services upon which our residents depend. And under the assumptions, Maryland could lose up to $1.6 billion in fiscal 24, $25.5 billion over the next 10 years. So this is not chump change. This is a lot of money. And again, that's just if the spending cuts were enacted. If we defaulted, of course, that's a way, way worse scenario. You're talking about a lot of job losses, around 8 million jobs, according to Moody's. The unemployment rate would come up to 8%. And then stock prices, Michael, would fall almost a fifth at the worst sell-off. And that, according to Moody's, would wipe out $10 trillion worth of household wealth. So we're talking about big, big numbers here, big impact, not only on the U.S. economy, but on the worldwide economy. This would have trickle effects around the world. So those are pretty big numbers. And I think that's why we're focused on this. We're paying attention and we're hopeful that Congress and the president can come to some resolution here. And Michael, if I had to guess, if I had to put my chips on the table, I think that, you know, it's pretty likely that they'll come to some sort of agreement. Maybe they just kick the can down the road a little bit and they say, we're going to suspend the debt limit for a set period of time, or they'll raise the debt limit. But you have to think that, you know, Republicans are going to get something out of this. And that's the other piece of this. If there is, you know, massive spending cuts in non-discretionary spending. So we're not talking about like military funding. This would be non-discretionary. And that's where the bulk of the money that counties and states rely on. If there were major cuts there, that certainly would have a big impact, particularly on Maryland. So that's where we are. We're hopeful that they strike a deal. I know that the National Association of Counties, NACO, has sent a letter urging them to come to an agreement and sort of outlining what this would mean for county governments. And we'll link all that in the show notes. But certainly this is something that, you know, we're concerned about, but I'm hopeful. And I do think they'll come to some resolution, because Michael, it's pretty unthinkable to imagine that we would default on our debt. But as you said, there are some people saying we should, and we'll have to see the appetite and how much Congress is willing to give to strike a deal here with the White House.
Yeah, I think that's about it. And one thing we do know from the recent times that this has been a controversy between the White House and Congress is they never resolve it until like 45 minutes before the deadline. So just the fact that they're negotiating with something like 2 weeks to spare, there's no reason to attach a whole lot of gravity to, oh my gosh, they seem far apart. They never have a deal worked out with 2 weeks to go. Right. So nothing brings negotiations together like a deadline. And there's a date circled on the calendar. I guess it's June 1st. So we should see the last days of May being the opportunity for some of these walls to come down, for the negotiations to get somewhere. And then maybe it turns into a bill with multiple facets and who knows, whatever. But that seems like the likeliest outcome. And I think, you know, for all intents and purposes, that's what we're rooting for, I think.
Yep. And I think, you know, people on Wall Street are smarter than we are. And I think that's a good indication. If you start to see things going south on Wall Street, it's a pretty good indication that they're not very confident that a deal can be struck. But we haven't seen that yet. Again, I know in the overnight markets, the dollar performed pretty well around the world. So I think smart people are looking at this and they're betting that there will be some sort of agreement. But I would I'd watch the markets as a good indicator, because, again, those people are way smarter than we are and they're dealing with a lot of money.
I'm buying it.
All right. Anything else, Michael, before we wrap up today? Anything else on the Preakness? Any more horses you want to throw in the mix? Or are you pretty set on what you got? I want you to make some big money on Saturday.
I don't know about that. I mean, I don't know, with your main horse in there at 20-1, I might have to factor him in, because that could be a crush ticket. We didn't even mention the Kentucky Derby winner, Mage,
yes,
who looked plenty impressive in that race. And I think the biggest issue here is he's a somewhat lightly raced horse. So to wheel back after a big effort just 2 weeks later sometimes can leave horses a bit tired. Most thoroughbreds at this age in particular will space out their races 4, 5, 6 weeks apart as a more typical schedule. And the lead up to the Kentucky Derby and the Triple Crown race is an exception to the rule. And usually the Derby winner comes back in the Preakness, but it's kind of telling that nobody else from the Derby field did so this year. But yeah, there's some strong shooters in this field. This is not going to be a walkover for him. And yeah, both of us seem to be looking elsewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. And if Mage is able to pull it off, and then, of course, then you have the Belmont, and then you have to run in the Belmont, right? I mean, typically, if you've won the first two, unless the horse you don't think he can run, I mean, the Belmont is where you really start to get into the thick of it and test that horse's endurance. That's a big turnaround and a quick turnaround. But if he does win the Preakness, you'd have to think that, I guess, you'd want to run him at the Belmont.
Yep. And then you only have 3 weeks off for that. So that's three big, long, demanding races in 5 weeks. It's not a surprise that it's relatively rare to have horse win the Triple Crown. Only twice in the last couple decades. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we can leave it there for today. Of course, again, we will link all of our coverage and stuff that we talked about here today on the podcast notes. So please take a look at that. As always, if you enjoy the podcast, please go ahead and subscribe. That way, all of these episodes will be sent directly to the device of your choice. You can also follow along on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and then, of course, you should always be reading the Conduit Street blog. But for Michael Sanderson, this is Kevin Canale signing off, and we will talk to you soon.